Okay, yeah, it is Human Rights Day, and we should be talking about human rights. We're going to talk about basic human rights. Every South African should know, because we talk about it in assumption that everybody understands it. And then when you listen to the conversations, you realize that you don't quite understand it completely, but it's important that we understand it. As South Africans celebrate Human Rights Day today, of course, we look at all the rights every citizen must know. Human rights are the basic rights a person is born with. Now, the Bill of Rights protects the rights of every South African. I guess it's important that all South Africans know their basic rights afforded to them. And that's the question. Do you know the full list of human rights? And do you know where the limits of your rights extend to? Moshami Chetty is the CEO of Aria Legal Solutions, and she joins us on the line now. Hello, Moshami. Great to have you.
Hi. Thank you so much. And thank you for getting my name right.
I've been briefed, and I needed to kind of go through your name a couple of times, so it's all good.
Thank you.
I got a very professional producer that helps me with these things. Moshami, great to have you. Of course, an important conversation given the day. What would you say is at stake if we don't know our rights?
Well, you know, I guess we have to view it against our history, that we come from many decades where South Africans didn't have basic human rights guaranteed to them, particularly to South Africans of color. So if we're not aware of those rights, we're actually losing out on the opportunity to enforce or have the kind of dignity or life that we didn't have in the past. And I think we're probably going to get into it a little bit later. But of course, our ability to enforce our human rights is also quite dependent on our ability to use the court system. And that is hampered in a number of ways. And of course, you need money to use the court system. So, yeah, it's quite a complex and nuanced question, but I don't know if we'll be able to cover in 15 minutes. But at the very least, being aware that you have a set of human rights allows you to, I guess, soft enforce them before you have to go to the court system. So if you had to have a conflict in the school system, for example, just the mere fact that you know that you have a right to religion would probably give you the ability to negotiate a positive outcome out of that.
But access to that court system and access to legal representation can be expensive and therefore can exclude the vast majority of people. So we must find a time for it in the 15 minutes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Does pro bono really kind of fill the void?
Pro bono is tough when it comes to enforcement of human rights. So I think we've got quite a workable pro bono system when it comes to civil disputes or criminal disputes. But when it comes to human rights, you know, you've got a few NGOs that fund that kind of work, but it can be quite expensive. And it's not particularly lucrative for the people who are in that system.
Sure.
And that human rights litigation can be quite long and extensive. So I'll give you an example. Recently, a colleague and a friend of mine succeeded in suing the Department of Home Affairs for creating effectively internally stateless persons. So you had a young man called Taboho who did not have, his parents died quite young, and he did not have an ID book and therefore was not able to apply for any opportunities, including basic support from the South African government or job opportunities. And this was something that was ongoing for about 10 years. The litigation took about 2.5 years. And the department is now obliged to create a solution for people that are internally stateless. They just can't prove that they were born here.
And is there a cost order that goes with that judgment?
There was a punitive cost order that went with that judgment. But as you can understand, there are not that many lawyers who want to be in that game because it takes quite a while. You have to fund that for 2.5 years.
And is it risky?
It is quite risky.
Regardless of the merits, when you're sitting on a case and you're looking at the merits, are you like, this is a winner, I'm prepared to do it from my activist kind of gut instincts?
Most people do it out of passion. They do. But you can imagine that in the grander scheme of things, the amount of access that you have to that level of legal service is quite narrow if you look at the broad spectrum of who the lawyers are in South Africa and the work that they're trying to do. But also this person's waiting 10 years for a solution. So I would still say that access to human rights legal services is still quite limited, despite the sterling work that a lot of NGOs do that are well-funded.
Yeah. You see, so it doesn't really matter how well you understand your human rights if you don't have access to the law. And again, I think I'm preferring that the majority of people in South Africa don't. Then it's absolutely useless. But let's go on, just in terms of understanding our rights. It's like a pecking order of sorts. Are there rights that are more important than others that we should be kind of, considering?
Well, that's kind of a tough question to answer because you shouldn't really think of it in terms of a hierarchy of rights. But when you look at how our Bill of Rights developed, as you would with any Bill of Rights in the world, the things that the country cares about, the things that are our foundational basis, usually create a sort of hierarchy about what matters most to us. So okay. In the United States, for example, freedom is very important to them. So things like freedom of speech and freedom of expression are quite high up on their hierarchy of needs. Some would say it doesn't even make sense how high they value those rights. But if you look at South Africa based on our history, the right to equality is quite important. And the right to dignity, while it may sound like a little bit wishy-washy, the right to dignity actually underpins every single other of our rights and considerations, because most of us have been denied dignity for so long, and one would say we continue to be denied dignity. So I would say that the right to equality and dignity strongly underpin the rest of the hierarchy of rights, if you had to call it that, within the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, and you can extrapolate from that as well into a kind of universal form of sorts. What if your country's laws, for example, in relation to let's say carbon emissions, are not in line with the rest of the world's commitments? That's also a human right, are you not? Because you are literally impelling the planet by not having or not being part of a collective effort. Is that a human right?
I mean, there are some countries that have environmental rights very strongly as human rights, indigenous rights very strongly as human rights. And that really depends on how that country has developed. So I'll give you another example. India, for example, has done a lot of work in developing the right to food. In South Africa, what our particular nuance or what set our Bill of Rights apart from, or made it, as some people describe it, the best constitution in the world, is that we had enforceable socioeconomic rights. So most Western Bill of Rights systems only have freedoms like of speech, life, dignity. They will not include socioeconomic rights like healthcare, housing, etc. So it was quite progressive for us to have fully enforceable socioeconomic rights. However, those rights have internal limitations to them, because, of course, you can't have a blanket enforceable human right to housing. No government would be able to enforce that. So it does say, progressive steps towards or reasonable steps towards. I think the only thing that isn't limited is emergency health care. So that was a very progressive step that we took, but I think as we've seen, 20-odd years after freedom, whether we've been able to achieve that is questionable.
Yeah. Then we have, I think, the issue of poverty is a pretty serious but very daunting challenge for South Africa. Highest Gini coefficient in the world, the biggest disparity between rich and poor. The poor kind of overlooked, their rights trampled upon. They're not getting the running water that was absolutely central to this new democracy in the first part of its existence. In the latter part of its existence, not enough investment into delivering basic needs like water. How can the poor find more respite through a constitution that guarantees their more than their existence, their rights?
I think it does flow into what we've just been talking about the enforceability of socioeconomic rights. I think we would definitely say that there's been a failure to progressively achieve that over time. Very early in our constitution, there were a number of court cases which dealt with that progressive rights to housing, for example. However, whether we've continued to, and the people who have the power, like those NGOs or the attorneys who work in the space, have continued to pursue that kind of litigation in order to enforce the government, to hold the government up to that standard of progressively providing better standards, is questionable. So I would say that our socioeconomic rights enforcement is probably really not what it should be. And again, if you're poor and you don't have access to the courts, and you're not quite aware of what those rights are, you know, it seems to be an empty right. And, you know, we've got some human rights writers and commentators who've said that in some senses, providing people with a set of rights can be a bit of a switch and bait. You know, once you possess a right, you feel that you've won or achieved something, whereas that may be an empty right and you haven't really had fulfillment of that right. So it remains a challenge. I think even here in the Western Cape, we see the Western Cape government sort of progressively and consistently underspending on their housing budget and returning it to government, not allotting land for affordable housing. And so there has been litigation around that, and there continues to be litigation around that. But it's a tough one. It's a tough one. I'm afraid that I don't have that much sort of you know, feel good, positive things to say about that today.
Sure. Moshami Chetty, my guest, CEO of Aria Legal. We're talking about basic human rights. Every South African should know. Let's touch on housing. If you're not delivering the housing, you're not spending your budgets, is it criminal?
It's not criminal, but it definitely is a breach of that obligation that the state has to progressively achieve that right. And we have had litigation which has set that out, and which, you know, but governments tend sometimes not to enforce that. Our constitutional court has been great about developing something called structural order. You know, it's tough if you think about the separation of the three arms of state, the executive, the legislative, and the courts. You'll often hear governments say that the courts should not overstep their bounds. And courts have to tread a very fine line. So there is something called a structural interdict, which courts will say, you've had the following failure. Within the, you know, next 3 months or 6 months, you must report to us on the following. And I think that's as far as our courts are probably willing to go.
Yeah, and you report back 3 months later, not much has been done. So again, the question, what's the use of a constitution if it guarantees you all of these human rights, including housing, as is possible, and a budget enables such a possibility, but the budget is not spent? In my mind, that's criminal.
So, you know, I think perhaps I should end this on a positive note.
Is it possible?
yes, it is possible. Because we have such a robust and well-crafted and well-thought-out constitution, whereas it may not avail every man on the street every hour of his life, if you look at the ability that our Bill of Rights has to curb the excesses or the failures of government, once the matter gets to court, I think it works very effectively because it set out a set of norms or set of beliefs or something to which South Africans want to aim as a best case scenario. And I think we can all agree that the courts strongly hold the line against the excesses or the failures of government. And I think you can see a very good line of case law which supports that.
Yeah.
There are just a lot of institutional, financial, etc., barriers in order to get there in the first place. But once we're there, I think it does serve its function.
I think, and I'm not a legally minded kind of person, but what I would like to see is government a little more accountable to the Constitution. Is that possible?
I think once you get a matter all the way to the Constitutional Court, or sometimes even in the High Court, and we find that there's been a failure, you have punitive cost orders, you have structural interdicts. You know, all of that gets carried through the media, which I guess is your function, and we get to hold government to account. But effectively, at the end of the day, the only true way to hold government to account is at the polls and legislatively.